Welcome to the IBD podcast series for primary care. I'm Charlie Andrews, a GP and regional clinical champion for IBD for the Royal College of General Practitioners and Crohn's and Colitis UK, and you're listening to episode 3, where I talk to a specialist dietitian about nutrition and IBD. I'd like to start by thanking Crohn's and Colitis UK for making the series possible. Throughout this series, I'll be bringing you expert advice from experts in various fields of IBD care, from diagnosis to nutrition and everything in between. I'm delighted to be joined today by Sam Poor. Sam is a senior specialist dietitian in gastroenterology and lower gastrointestinal surgery at Bristol Royal Infirmary. He has 10 years experience supporting people with IBD at every stage of their disease, from basic advice on diet through to supporting patients who have had major surgery and require IV nutrition. Patients are increasingly interested in diet and dietary modification to manage gastrointestinal symptoms. And from my own experience, diet's often brought up with me by IBD sufferers. In this episode, we'll cover a variety of topics, including malnutrition in IBD and how to assess for this. We'll discuss how to manage the patient who asks, "What should I eat?" And we'll explore some of the issues around dietary modification in IBD. We'll also talk about the low FODMAPs diet with relation to IBD, as well as advice around ileostomies. We'll also look at the fascinating world of the microbiome and if probiotics can help people with IBD. But first, I'd like to begin by discussing malnutrition and IBD and how we can assess for nutritional status. So let's start, Sam, by talking a bit about why people with IBD are at risk of malnutrition.
Yes, well, people can be at risk of malnutrition for various reasons. It might be because of the disease affecting their bowel and absorption of nutrients in their small intestine. And it also might be due to the fact that they're in pain and suffering from symptoms which has reduced their appetite and meant they don't want to eat very much. They associate food causing their symptoms, so feel that they just don't want to eat and cause the pain that way.
So that's really interesting, isn't it? Because it's not all about malabsorption, it's also about them voluntarily reducing their intake and avoiding certain foods.
So that's right.
Yeah. And if we talk about the malabsorption side, sometimes it's helpful to think about where the patient's disease is, because I believe that that affects what sort of nutritional deficiency we might see.
That's right. The small intestine is the site where absorption of nutrients takes place. And because Crohn's disease can affect any area of the gut from mouth right down to the anus, it can affect any area of the small intestine. And it quite commonly affects the terminal ileum, where vitamin B12 and iron can be absorbed. And so those are quite commonly poorly absorbed, and calcium too. Then in ulcerative colitis, that only affects the colon, where nutrients are not absorbed, but fluid does get absorbed. So there may be an element of dehydration related to disease affecting the colon.
I'm going to draw you back to some of the nutrients you talked about there so that we can delve a little bit deeper into them, if that's all right. So, for example, iron. So iron deficiency anemia is really common, isn't it? So I think up to a third of patients with active disease will be iron deficient. Can we talk a bit more about iron and how that can be affected?
Yeah, so iron may be affected because of blood losses. It may be due to poor absorption from the diet. It may be because of an insufficient intake in the diet. So there's various reasons why there may be low iron levels. Something that's quite easy to check on blood tests, so we can pick that up quite easily and then determine if supplementation is necessary.
I think that's a really important point, isn't it? Because the threshold for iron deficiency in active disease is different, isn't it? So, for example, if your iron levels are below 100 micrograms per litre, that would classify as iron deficient in someone who's got active disease, whereas in someone without active disease, that might be a completely normal level. But in active inflammation, our thresholds do go up. So we have to think about that. And it might be important to check, for example, transferrin saturation instead.
Perhaps, yes. And that's something that can be included on the routine blood tests. Patients with very low iron levels may need an iron infusion. They may need just general iron supplements. It's unlikely that they're going to be able to get their iron levels up by diet. They often ask me about what they can eat and drink to try and improve their iron levels in their diet. And we can certainly advise them on that, but it's unlikely to make a very big difference to their iron levels. Mm. And it would probably be due to their consultant, therefore, to decide whether they needed an iron infusion or iron supplements of one sort or another.
And if we move on to calcium and vitamin D, because those are obviously very important and they can be quite deficient in people with active inflammatory bowel disease.
Yes, so calcium, very important for the bones, obviously, and calcium intakes might be low. Quite commonly, patients with inflammatory bowel disease report lactose intolerance, or there is an association between eating and drinking dairy food and their symptoms, and therefore they may have reduced their calcium intake by cutting out that group of foods, and so they may be calcium deficient because they're just simply not getting enough dairy in their diet. And again, absorption in the gut might be poor because of the site of disease, so that's also something to consider. And when patients are on steroids to control their inflammation, that can affect the absorption of calcium, and so increased loss of bone density is a risk for those patients.
In terms of the nutritional assessment of someone, what would you advise that we do to assess someone's nutritional status?
Well, there's simple assessments that you can do to start with. So just checking body weight, body mass and body mass index are quite easy ways to gauge that. Asking somebody about their dietary intake, some simple questions to find out the range of foods they're eating and also the foods that they've cut out. So if somebody has cut out, for instance, dairy food, they've probably also cut out quite a large group of energy-rich foods, and that will have an effect on their energy intake. Sometimes patients also cut out things like red meat because they associate red meat with causing symptoms, or other large food groups. And so by cutting out a large food group like that, they have restricted their diet quite considerably, and that can lead quite easily to a level of malnutrition.
And I suppose that leading on from the nutrients you were talking about, checking blood tests is probably sensible as well. So having a look at some of those micronutrients that they might be low in that we talked about earlier.
Yeah, so routine blood tests can pick up certainly things like iron and vitamin B12, folic acid, folate. So those are easy ways to check for certain things. Blood tests can't pick up all nutrient deficiencies, so there are limitations there. And sometimes symptoms as well. So when patients report problems with hair loss or skin problems, nail problems, those perhaps can be indicators of undernutrition.
We're now going to move on to diet, if that's okay. You mentioned about people restricting their diet and potentially becoming a bit deficient, but there are lots of different diets out there that people are increasingly interested in following. What advice would you give us to a patient who comes to see their GP saying, I'd like to follow, for example, a restrictive diet of some sort? What advice would you have for us around that?
Well, there's various, all sorts of diets for different reasons. Some diets are not necessarily appropriate or specific to inflammatory bowel disease. It depends what their reason for wanting to follow the diet is. All the diets restrict to a certain degree and cut out various groups of food for one reason or another. So you have to be careful that they aren't restricting their diet and making themselves malnourished in a particular food group. And there also needs to be a good account of how they're going to replace the foods that they do cut out with suitable alternatives to make sure they are still having a varied and balanced and nutritious diet. So it's important that they do have a good dietary assessment, are given good information on what to cut out, but also essentially the suitable alternative foods to replace. So quite commonly food diets that might help would be things like the low FODMAPs diet, which cuts out a group of carbohydrates that are prone to causing excess gas in the intestine and fluid in the intestine. That swells the intestine up, makes you uncomfortable, and is a diet that's been very, very useful for irritable bowel syndrome. And patients with inflammatory bowel disease do seem to experience quite a high level of functional gut symptoms like those in irritable bowel syndrome. And therefore, the low FODMAPs diet can be a quite useful diet to consider, particularly for patients in remission. But again, it's a very restricted diet. It should only be followed for a short period of time. And it's essential that patients get good information, good written information and comprehensive information on what to include in their diet while they're following those sorts of diets.
I think it's really interesting that you brought up the low FODMAP diet and the IBS overlap, really, in inflammatory bowel disease. It's so important for us as GPs to be aware that somewhere up to about a third of patients with IBD will also suffer with IBS-type symptoms. And it's so important as GPs that in order to avoid overuse of steroids, that we make sure that if someone does come in with newer symptoms, that we're making sure that this is a flare of IBD and we use objective tests to look for that. So I think, you know, I'm glad that you brought that up because I think it's a really important point that there is this functional symptom overlap in inflammatory bowel disease. Sometimes diet is used as therapy, am I right?
That's right, yes. Yeah. So diet can be used in flare of inflammatory bowel disease, particularly in Crohn's disease, to help rest the gut. And that can usually be used alongside medication and medical therapy. So in those instances, we might use a liquid diet. So patients would be prescribed a complete nutritional supplement, which is complete with vitamins and minerals, to meet their energy and protein requirements for a period of time, hopefully a fairly short, but maybe up to 6 to 8 weeks. And that would hopefully help them achieve remission alongside their medical therapy. In some cases, it can be used as a sole source of therapy, but it's quite difficult to stick to as a sole source of nutrition.
And people with these liquid diets, they may be in the community, so they might well be discharged and they might be following this diet in the community, am I right?
That's right, yeah. So it's something that they can do at home. There's no need to stay in hospital while following a liquid diet. And they will be offered outpatient support during that phase to help make sure that they're having sufficient drinks to maintain their energy intake and to make sure that they're not on it for any longer than they need to be.
Okay. I'm going to move in a completely different direction here, Sam, and talk about ileostomies. Unfortunately, surgery can be a fact of life for patients with IBD. So, for example, bowel resections in Crohn's disease requiring defunctioning ileostomies, etc., is not uncommon. So can you talk a bit about some general advice for patients with ileostomies that might come to see us in general practice?
Yes, so patients with an ileostomy will probably find that they have a very liquid output through their ileostomy. They might lose quite a lot of fluid through their ileostomy output, and so they need to pay very careful attention to their hydration status. And they also will probably need to restrict their fibre intake so that they don't increase the amount of intestinal losses through their ileostomy. There can be quite considerable salt losses if their ileostomy output is high, so we need to make sure they're not becoming salt deplete. Most patients will probably find that there's sufficient salt in their diet to meet their salt needs, but that's something we do need to bear in mind, particularly patients who might complain of cramps a lot with their ileostomy. That might be an indication that they're not getting sufficient fluid or salts in their diet, so we need to be careful there. And blood tests can help with that as well. And those patients that are becoming dehydrated with their ileostomy output may need to be prescribed or shown how to make up special electrolyte drinks that will replace their salt, which have a high level of salt in their fluids, to help them meet their salt needs and improve the absorption in their gut.
And might that be things like Dowrolite or making up an oral rehydration solution at home?
That's right, yeah. So solutions such as St. Mark's solution would be an example there.
Great. Now, again, we're moving in a very different direction once again, and we're going to talk a bit about probiotics and the microbiome, because there's so much interest in the microbiome at the moment. And just to give you an overview of that, the microbiome really relates to the internal environment of the bowel and the idea that there are quite a few gut bacteria that live symbiotically with us in our bowel and perform very important functions generally. But in people with inflammatory bowel disease, there appears to be an imbalance of that microbiome. And there's a lot of interest in whether or not altering the microbiome can be a therapy for people with IBD. And that's where probiotics come in. Is that right, Sam?
Yeah, so, I mean, we know that inflammatory bowel disease is affected by an alteration in the gut microbiome. And so it would seem logical then that probiotics might be a good way to help adjust that or replace any that are lost or rebalance the gut microbiome. And there has been, as you mentioned, a huge amount of research in this area. The only problem is there hasn't really been any strong conclusive evidence that supports the use of probiotics in inflammatory bowel disease, unfortunately. And we don't really have any good guidance that we can offer patients. It's likely that those patients that do want to try a probiotic will probably not come to any harm by trying a probiotic product, but it's there's no guarantee in them achieving any benefit from taking it.
And there's a huge number on the market as well, aren't there? And it can be quite a minefield navigating that.
That's right, yes. There's all sorts of products that you can buy in the supermarket or from health food shops or online. And different people will cite benefits they might have achieved with different ones, or people will recommend all sorts of different products that they might have found useful. But again, you know, that's very much down to anecdotal evidence, which we can't necessarily use as strong evidence to support them. What I probably would suggest is if somebody did want to try a probiotic would be to research it themselves, look at the product, look into the product, have a look at how much it costs, because the products vary enormously in price. Some of the online ones are very expensive, but are more highly supported by some of the anecdotal evidence that there is around them. So for patients to read up on them, become very well self-informed about it, try a product for 1 to 3 months, no more than 3 months, and if they haven't noticed any benefit, to stop using it.
That's really good advice. In your opinion, Sam, who do you feel would benefit from a dietary assessment? I know that in the IBD standards, it suggests, well, it advises that every patient diagnosed with inflammatory bowel disease should have access to a dietitian and be able to have a nutritional assessment. But if you've got the patients who have had it for some time, who do you think would benefit from seeing someone like yourself?
I think somebody who is having ongoing symptoms, gastrointestinal symptoms, especially if they're in remission and struggling with symptoms, they would benefit from a dietetic assessment to establish whether an exclusion diet, such as the low FODMAPs diet, might help them. And I think that's something that should be done in association with a dietitian, with the support of a dietitian, because it's a difficult diet to follow and does need expert advice. So those patients, definitely. Any patient who appears to be malnourished using a malnutrition screening tool or by any other obvious signs, they should be seen by a dietitian if possible. So those two groups of patients would definitely benefit.
Great. Well, we're coming to the end now, Sam. But this is your opportunity to speak to GPs and give them your key messages on diet and IBD. So take it away.
Well, I think I'd definitely advise that patients should try and consume as varied a diet as possible. It's very easy for people to restrict foods without replacing them, particularly if they haven't noticed any benefit. And in remission, there will hopefully be no problem with food absorption. So it's really important that people have as varied a diet as they possibly can so they can get the benefit of a wide variety of nutrients. So that's key. I think it's really important that patients have an assessment of their nutritional status, even if it's a fairly simple assessment, to make sure that we are not ignoring the risk of malnutrition. It can be as high as 85% in patients with IBD. So I think it's really important that we do look out for those patients who are at higher risk.
That's great. Thank you, Sam. Well, thank you very much for joining me today. You've given us plenty of food for thought on nutrition and IBD today, so that was fantastic. I know that I'm asked about diets by patients with IBD quite frequently, and so I've included in the show notes some links to two helpful resources for patients that I often direct patients to. The first is the Crohn's and Colitis UK food booklet, and the second is a webinar that's delivered by a team of expert dietitians, Sam being one of them, that's directed at patients to try and help inform them about healthy eating and diet choices with IBD. And this can be found at www.patientwebinars.co.uk. So thank you very much for listening.